Welcome to another episode of Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history each episode. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today from the Lantern Cast, it's Chad Bokelman. Hi, Chad.
Hey, Siskoid. How's it going? Thanks for having me on.
Yes, you're on hiatus right now from the Lantern Cast, so it's not clear if you're ever going to return to that show.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. You know, I've been doing it for myself and my fellow co-host, Mark. We've been doing the Lantern Cast longer than the people who created the Lantern Cast in the first place did it. So it's been on the air 14 years at this point. So I'm just trying my hand at other things, seeing where things go.
well, let's try our hand at this. You've chosen to take part in a panel by panel, perhaps one of the most niche shows that we have. So let's just do the randomized series of choices that use my database of available comic book materials, either physical or digital. And prior to the recording, we did roll up a year, a month, a comic on the stands that month, a page, and finally a panel, the discrete unit of comic book storytelling. And in this case, we rolled the year, 1977, the month of May. Among all the comics out that month, the revolving finger falls on Aquaman number 57, actual cover date September, by writer David Michelinie and artist Jim Aparo. Page 7 of 17 and panel 4 of 4. And you'll find that and the page and the proper context in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So, Chad, Aquaman fan?
Yes, Aquaman fan to an extent. Obviously not to an extent of a Rob Kelly or something like that. It's something I have a couple of trades of on my shelf, but nothing that I intentionally seek out. I've been on a kick of buying some silver Bronze Age keys and stuff recently, because as much as I love DC and stuff, I'm never going to be able to afford Golden Age issues as much as I may want to.
Right.
But those Silver Age issues and stuff like that just get more and more expensive. So I do have in my collection one of those old Nick Carty Silver Age Aquaman covers. I think he was holding like Mara in his arms or something to that effect, was screaming in a very Superman holding Supergirl type style. If I'm remembering the artist right, I believe that was Nick Carty. But Aquaman doesn't take over a large percentage of my collection, but he is in there in the fact that I am a DC fan. And you can't dive, for lack of a better term, you can't dive into DC without diving into some Aquaman at some point.
And with Jim Aparo at the doing the art, we get a good one.
100%. 100%.
You know, this is random. Sometimes we don't get a good one.
No, for sure. Jim Aparo is, pivotal at DC, especially at this time. We're talking, you know, great stuff over at Batman, obviously great stuff with Aquaman. And then, of course, you know, shout out to Rob Kelly yet again, some Phantom Stranger. You can't go wrong with Aparo Phantom Stranger. Aparo's Phantom Stranger is what I picture in my head when I think of Phantom Stranger.
Oh,
so
there you go. All right. Well, let's describe this panel. You know, it's at the bottom of page four of page 7. Will you do the honors?
We are in the murky depths of the water and eyes wide in terror and shock. It looks like we see Aquaman very entangled in some coiled tentacles of a giant squid as they kind of grapple with one another. Aquaman's right hand, is grasped firmly on the end of one of these tentacles, and he's struggling to free himself underwater as yet another tentacle seems to be creeping towards him. And we're talking about Jim Aparo. He does very well at conveying some movement in this panel with some different lines around both the captured King of the Sea and his tentacled captor. Additionally, Arthur's kind of, you know, buttery rich blonde hair is being pushed forward in front of his head by the water to help further convey the kind of unnatural direction he's being moved in. And lastly, the kind of bubbles in the background streaming from the areas where like the most movement is shown around his fist and head is kind of like a final note of this single panel to help convey that motion. There's lots of stuff on the page to help push the idea that this is a sequence in motion and that something very unexpected and perhaps deadly is happening to Arthur Curry at the moment. The narration caption there says, "The word is dead, Aquaman," as Aquaman has a startled, jagged voice bubble just of GLMF. I don't know how you would pronounce that, but he's obviously trying to say something or express something and is being cut off by the tentacles being wrapped around his mouth.
Glimpf.
Yeah, there you go.
Very nice job. Obviously, there's a elephant in the room, you know, giant tentacle monster in the room. There's some sexual innuendo here that I think would be crass to mention, but criminal not to. So... Do you see it, or am I the dirty old man here?
You can't involve tentacles and not have that brief flash of perverse nature flash through your head for a moment, especially in today's modern age where it's so prevalent, it's probably referenced here and there all over the place in pop culture. I'll admit I didn't see it immediately, but the minute you mentioned it, I was like, yeah, of course he's going there. So nothing against you, Siskoid.
There's nothing wrong with sexual innuendo, and maybe the artist is having a little fun with it. I don't know. Like, you know, they love, in the 70s, they love pushing that comics code.
100%.
They love to do that. And in this case, the way he's, it's not the hentai, because obviously in 1977, you know, Jim Aparo has no notion of what hentai is. But the way that, he's kind of grasping where it is on his body, where, you know, that grasping that tendril and also going, there's something about that, I think. We'll leave it there. But when you look at the panel, it's hard not to see a little bit of a sex joke if you do want to see it. That's all I'm going to say about it. So obviously, one of the things I like about looking at a panel divorced from the rest, divorced from its page, divorced from its comic, is what story it tells by itself without a context. And here it's like, obviously in context, his dialogue is being interrupted. Just the way you said it. When the caption says the word is dead, it's like he's failing to say a word because he's been interrupted by that tentacle. But alone, just like without any other context, I feel like if you put this in an art gallery, for example, you'd get, I don't know, a sort of meta commentary, because Aquaman says a nonsense series of consonants and the caption is the word is dead. Not the word you're looking for is quote unquote dead, just the word is dead. Language is dead. And so Aquaman cannot express himself. So there's something there that you can like make it more high art just by reducing the content that you look at.
No, 100%. And I really talked a lot about the movement of the panel. There's so much happening here, because the little wiggle lines all around the tentacles where his fist is, around top to where his head is, the shock in his face, and the fact that the bubbles are sort of there to help convey that they're kind of thrashing about there together. But to me, I think the biggest thing that conveys movement is the very unnatural way in which Aquaman's hair is facing, because you don't see this sort of, I don't know, today's standards, like a curly faux hawk sort of a thing where it's kind of pushed forward in front of his face and his eyes. That's an unnatural thing. When you see Aquaman swimming, you know, he's one of the fastest swimmers, if not the fastest swimmer on the planet. So his hair is always like being pushed back when it's depicted. If it is longer when it's being depicted, it's being pushed back by his momentum through the water. So clearly using the water as a way to convey the movement, not just with the bubbles, but with the fact that he's being wrapped up, but he's kind of being brought backwards and, you know, thrashed about by him. Like, he's being pulled sort of backwards in this panel, it looks like, because his hair is being pushed in the direction, the opposite direction of which his body is moving through the water.
Back and also being tipped forward in the same, you know, there's something.
Yeah.
One of the things that we didn't mention is that it's a thin vertical panel. And so we have the idea of depth within, you know, with an up and a down. And Aquaman is tipped unnaturally, you know. And so those bubbles are rising up. So they all create that sense of verticality and all those lines, and it's darker on both sides. He's in the abyss, and somewhere it's like lighter where he is, because we have to look at it, obviously. It's important in Aquaman comics, I think, Aquaman and Namor, to show that when you're underwater, you know, it's not just a normal environment. So an artist that doesn't do that fails. And in this case, I think Jim Aparo is working on, you know, different ways of making it happen, whether it's the unnatural angle, whether it's the darkness at the bottom or at the top, whether it's the bubbles, the greenish, bluish bubbles going up, you know. I almost feel like this is a stream of algae in a way, because of the color. You know, there's like a current with algae on it or something that's in the background that helps create this movement. And the hair. the way the hair flows is very much, you wouldn't normally do that if there was air, you know, but because it's water, there's a flow, and you so seldom see that because he's got a short haircut. I feel like you don't see that a lot in Aquaman comics.
You know, there's a couple of things I don't really like in comics when I'm reading them, and it's a wasted background, mm-hmm. which this is not. We see the bubbles, and we know that Aquaman's kind of in the depths here. So I do actually like that instead of choosing to make the background all black, we're kind of focused on the action. And as you mentioned, the top part of the panel is black, as was the bottom part. But it also, the black sort of fades out and becomes kind of sketch lines in some way to just sort of denote the idea that kind of, you know, as your eye strays from the action, so does your focus on whatever's in front of you because you're underwater. So I like that. I also like here that despite the use of what, maybe one, two, three, maybe four or five different shades of blue-green in one panel, it doesn't look awash in blue-green here. It helps make his blonde hair, the white face of his skin, the pieces of his orange suit that you can see through the tentacles wrapped around him stand out a little more. But we can see, like, the tentacles are one color of green, his glove is one color of green, the bubbles are a different color of green, and so is this sort of, you know, murky background color opposite of black that we're seeing here. It'd be very easy for this to just seem like all one color, but the colorist did a good job of just making these distinctive shades of green pop within each other.
If it were a Jim Shooter Marvel comic, it'd be all one shade, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I was going to say the darker shades, you know, like a darker tone because you are in the depths. And so you want to create that sort of dingier atmosphere. I mean, this is why Aquaman is a blonde hero with an orange shirt. He needs to pop on those blue backgrounds, sure. Those darker backgrounds. What do we make of the pink aura around that spiky speech bubble? I know it matches the caption box, and I'm guess, you know, of course it pops from the background because of its color, but why not make it entirely white? Why does it have that pink aura inside the bubble?
I don't know. I didn't think about it till now, but you're right. That is a weird sort of choice. I would think it would be all white. I wonder if it's maybe a coloring mishap in some way, because I wonder about this little kind of box of white that's in front of his eyes there. That's clearly got to be part of the background because you can see the way the lines of movement and the kind of jagged lines of to help further convey the shock in his eyes and stuff like that is there. So I wonder if that's a coloring mistake. So if you see this one coloring mistake, you think that maybe the same could be said of this bubble. I think the fact that the glumph has the exclamation point and then the lines on either side of it help really drive home the fact that his speech is being cut off. He's making some sound effect. He's trying to say something that is being cut off. And then the jagged nature of the speech bubble is enough to convey the shock, as is the exclamation point. So I don't know what point the pink drives home, other than the fact that it's a slightly sharper color, a shade of pink than the narrative bubble, but it sort of matches the narrative bubble. And I'm not sure what role it plays there.
For my part, I don't feel like that white square is necessarily a mistake. Although I agree that like the shape of it is odd, but it feels like they're just... Yeah. I think it's supposed to be a flash of white that goes with those lines okay. of shock, which is so a completely expressionistic element. But the shape of it, I agree, there's like what happened there. But with the pink glow, which I wish was more equal on every side, that's also why we might think it's a coloring problem.
Yeah.
Here's how I see it. First of all, it's interesting because it's spiky. It's meant to represent a shout or a scream.
Right.
But the content is muffled. Glumph is not a scream. It's not a shout. We get like a contrast there where it's at once smothered and also, you know, loud. And so when I look at the pink, I'm thinking, okay, is it like the colors coming in? Like he's seeing red, like the colors coming in, almost like he's got blood in his mouth. You know, that color is coming to smother the word in the same way that he's being smothered or something. So there's maybe something there that's being done on purpose. I'm not sure the colorist like got it where it was supposed to go necessarily, which is surprising because I feel like the rest of it is so well done. you know, like very close shades, one close to the other, but you can definitely tell that the squid and the water aren't the same. And I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. And I think the other things I really kind of like about the Aquaman's hand there, what is, that's grasping the tentacle. You can see that Aparo has taken some time to, you know, obviously make sure that, I mean, it looks like a tentacle. As a tentacle goes closer to the source, the body of the being that it's attached to, it's going to get thicker and thicker and thicker. But in addition to the wiggle lines around it and the way that he's drawing his fist, because as you and I know, whenever you tighten your fist and you tighten it really, really hard, you know, your knuckles seem to bump up a lot more, as does his right here. How tight he's gripping his fist, there's no way that he's not got like a stranglehold on this tentacle. It's not a loose grip, and you know, he's in a dire situation. You wouldn't think it would be, but he's very clearly squeezing it in a certain way, because there's no way the tentacle is getting much bigger under his hand. Whereas, you know, realistically, artistically speaking, especially if you look at the tentacle above his head, that it would be a thicker piece of tentacle where his hand is currently.
Maybe it's got a little give, you know, maybe it's rubbery. But, you know, speaking of grips, obviously the creature has him in its grip. And I just kind of realized this, that, of course, when you're looking at the whole page, you see the whole monster, etc. But the tentacle, the loose tentacle that's coming in and sort of, I don't know, going to like tap him on the shoulder or something, that thing, that's the only place where we see suckers.
Yeah.
Right? So he makes sure that in that this, if all we're looking at is this panel, we still know that it's not, I don't know, like rubber tubes or, you know, it is that creature. It is a squid or octopus. You know, it's got to have those suckers. So you see the suckers on that last tentacle, and it's the only place that we do see it. And of course, that explains why Aquaman is smothered, you know, because you can imagine he's got a sucker on his mouth, because, I mean, look at the physics of this. If he just pulls his neck back, then he can speak, you know? So it's got to be sticky.
You're right. The suckers help convey that it's a cephalopod of some kind, because, which also helps convey the look of shock on his face there too, because, you know, he doesn't have to speak for his telepathy or whatever you want to call it with the marine life to work. He's being entangled by some sort of underwater cephalopod and he's unable to control it.
Right.
And it's going up against him. So like, even if you don't know the context, the larger context of this panel or the page or even the entire comic, you can get a good sense of what's happening within the overall situation just by the fact that this creature is clearly not obeying him.
Right. In the context of Aquaman strips, this is shocking.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Oh, yeah. I'm still looking at it, and the way my eye bounces through, it's normal for an artist, or I mean, it should be like the minimal requirement that a page is well composed, but you don't necessarily need to have every panel well composed. And in this case, this one really is, because the way we've talked a lot about movement, and when you follow the movement, you're always bouncing up and down the image and never leaving it. It keeps you in that moment. It grips you in the same way that the squid has Aquaman. You know, you're following, you go from the speech bubble, the line points down, obviously, the point to Aquaman, who is looking, and you follow his gaze to the tentacle, and that tentacle is supported by some foaming green, you know, algae or water current or bubbles coming up. So you're going back up. And as you go back up, you come back down every time. You know, it's almost like that caption, "The word is dead," stops you from leaving the panel and then bounces you back up. And that's the mark of a great image, is that your eye can't ever leave it.
Yeah, the bubbles are oriented, which, you know, you refer to algae, I refer to bubbles. Either way, they're floating upwards to help. Actually, in a way, it almost makes the vertical panel longer than it actually is, because it's situating you in space. And as you follow those movement lines, you can clearly see, you know, obviously with his hair moving forward and the wiggle lines there, like, you know, he is being wrapped up in this creature and being kind of shaken. But also, he's got his hands on one of the tentacles and shaking that. And then the movement of all of that is even further, that tentacle that we see the suckers on, you can in your mind see that kind of snaking. Like if you were to put movement on this panel, one of the first things you would probably do is see that tentacle come snaking off panel down around his shoulder.
And for you, this wasn't Like, when you saw this panel, this wasn't your first time.
This is not. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I recognize this panel because, as I said, you know, if you're somebody who's just big into DC and DC history, there's every character has some story you have to read of that character. And for me, it's one of the few trade paperbacks of Aquaman I've read before, and it's Death of a Prince. This happens after Manta kills Aquaman's son.
Right. Aquaman number 57. So we're in one of the classic eras of the character, immediately recognizable to you.
And it helps further set the panel, too, because while I was speaking earlier, the idea that the cephalopod is not responding to him, it's because when he's going after Manta, Manta has sort of a army of robotic sea life, including manta rays and a robotic squid.
Even in that context that you just gave, Aquababy has just been killed. You know, Aquaman is powerless. There's just something about that, you know, that when we reached into the randomizer, the panel that they gave us was also, you know, also gave us the mood of that whole arc.
Yeah, exactly. And it the context also puts more in the panel than I think it's not like we didn't see it before. It just adds more intensity to it, because first you see what looks like shock or terror or anything, but you also, like, now that you know context, is there's sort of a desperation, a like his son has been killed and he is going after Manta, and you know, later on we see he nearly kills the guy, but, like, you know, he was so close to grabbing Manta in this moment, and now he's being stopped by this squid. And by the way, yes, he did summon some marine life to help him in this moment, but they were stopped by the other of the robotic army that Manta has. So Aquaman is not able to be saved by his marine life that he's called to help with. So he is stuck having to work himself out of this situation. It adds this sense of desperation to the panel. And I think everything that it adds to the panel, the proper context of understanding it, is also still very well displayed by Jim Aparo here, even if you saw this panel without having known the prior context.
I think you're right about that desperation, just the shape of the eyebrows. Uh-huh. Like, I'm looking at because you sort of have to, you know, tip your head a little bit to see the expression dead on. And yeah, there's something there. There's a sort of remote sadness that I would identify with desperation. Yeah, a very strong panel. We were quite lucky. Any last comments on this before we move on?
Jim Aparo's a god. That's all you got. That's all we need.
Well, thank you, Chad. You want to tell people what you're working on right now? You've been sampling some shows?
Appearing on a couple shows here and there, seeing what's out there, getting some ideas of maybe some my own stuff, or maybe possibly hosting other things. I don't know. I've worked with Aaron Head Moss. We talked for some of his podcasts recently, and obviously you and I are speaking. As far as other stuff I've got in the works, I would love to, you know, this being the new year and all, I'd love to come out and say that I've got shows that are returning, but I've done that before and I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch. So I would love to bring back, like, the Action Comics Weekly podcast, but I've made those promises before and I don't want to do that again. But one main project I will at least be adding some episodes to in the new year will be my Creative Credit podcast. It's a podcast I started a long time ago where I can interview any comic book creator from any ilk, whether it be writer, artist, letterer, inker, publisher, editor, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter, from any company, any character at any time. And that is just because, you know, with the Lantern Cast, I got lucky enough to get press passes to conventions and stuff like that. And I'd be going through Artist Alley meeting these amazing people. But I'd always have to be like, okay, love your work, but did you maybe ink an issue of Green Lantern in the 80s so I have an excuse to speak to them on the air? And I got really sick of that. So I was just like, I have access to creators and I just want to hear about how their job is and what it's like in the industry, and really put some context behind, I guess, some of the fanboy rage that happens out there, and let people really understand what this industry is really about. So Creative Credit, well, I was lucky enough to start that show off by interviewing Steve the Dude Rude, and I've since interviewed some fantastic people, a couple in the past year, and I hope to do that again in 2023. It is a passion project. I am not a writer, I'm not an artist, but I really love talking to comic book creators and understanding what's going on in their world. So Creative Credit, I think, is where people can hope people can find me in 2023.
All right. We'll wish you good hatching on that egg. I'll let you go back to the margins. We'll listen to a short promo, and I'll be back with listener feedback on our previous episode.
Thanks for having me.
To tell you the story of Green Lantern is to tell you the story of the birth of a universe, the origins of DC as a whole.
It's a magic emerald meteor from space in the 1940s.
It's the establishment of the JSA.
It's the birth of the Silver Age.
It's the introduction of a universal police force.
It's the formation of the JLA.
It's the emergence of the multiverse.
It's a crisis in both space and time.
It's an emerald dawn.
And it's an emerald twilight.
It's the brightest day.
And the blackest night.
And the Lantern Cast covers all of this and everything in between. We're Green Lantern's greatest advocates and fiercest critics. We've been fans for years, and it's the reason we're self-proclaimed Lanternologists.
So find us on iTunes and Stitcher and give us a listen, because the history of Green Lantern really is the history of the DC Universe. And we've got the interviews, commentaries, reviews, and more to back it up.
And now your feedback on our previous episode, which I called Winter is Coming, with special guest José Robichaud, art girl from Oh Hot More Not, a silent panel from the graphic novel Dragon Dynasty 1, The Wrath of Ying Long from 2010. And let's read them comment by comment. Captain Entropy says it was both educational and a great pleasure to hear you and José discuss this panel and its context, both on the page and more generally. Thank you especially for including so much brilliant artwork, including art girls, in the gallery. And I know it's an unpaid labor of love for you, but if you have the time and opportunity to put up a gallery page and add more content, I'm enthusiastically in favor. This is a question we asked. Should I buff up the gallery? Because very often it's just that one panel, and it is kind of ridiculous, but it's the only way to see it clean, not within a banner. Anyway, he says this episode was a great example of why I should be doing that. He says, I also appreciate every opportunity to hear from a member of the Hot Squad performing solo. Not only do they each have a lot to offer as individuals, it also helps me distinguish their voices. Martin Gray says, what a treat to hear you and José speaking on with such authority. I think I learned a thing or two, and cheers for sharing José's art. I'd never heard of deliberately blurred art. Is there a name for that school of art? The Cataraxisists? It's very clever and impressive. Nice one, José. Paul Kien says, excellent podcast. I really enjoyed the art discussion, including José's experience making prints. And Ange says he loved this one. I wonder if I would have intuited the passing of time nature of this panel without hearing about it. It was great to hear José and Usiskoid talk about art and techniques. Is printmaking part of standard Canadian art lessons in school or something sought out in higher education? Well, I will say printmaking is such a costly and equipment-intensive set of media that it isn't generally taught in schools beyond very simple printmaking like stamping. I would guess, you know, just carve a potato and use that as a stamp. We both did printmaking in university. José has a degree in fine arts, and I dicked around with a course or two because I was friends with the professor. Anyway, Ange completes his comment by saying, as for the gallery, I like seeing the panel on that post, but would love the page as well for further context clues. And thank you for including the crow print from José on this episode. So, you got me, guys. You beat me. You convinced me. I will be putting up, like, even this very show has not just the panel, but the page. Maybe a little something else, you know, when it's relevant. On that note, I'll remind you of our Patreon. That's what keeps the Fire and Water Podcast Network afloat. We got to host a lot of shows, guys, and that costs money. So if you'd like to make a donation, go off to patreon.com/FWPodcasts and do so. You can even unlock some rewards there. And as ever, a reminder that if you'd like to do one of these short podcasts, drop me a line and we'll arrange it. You will be handed a comic book panel randomly and we'll put it up for discussion. My thanks again to my guest, Chad Bokelman. And until we refill that seat, the panel is open.